Yeah, now let's record it. Okay. So I'm going to again review a little bit about what we'll be doing in this class, because when I went through this yesterday, I did an overview, but I also knew that there were about six students who were registered for the class who weren't here yesterday. One has shown up. But I don't know what's happened to the other five. Maybe they're just never going to show up, so I don't know. But there were a number of things by way of an overview that I didn't talk about yesterday that I do want to talk about. So it's just as well, in a sense, that the recording didn't happen, because we would have had redundant recordings if that had happened, I suppose. Okay. But the way I'm going to do this is by going to the first link in here, which is, what is pluralism? So when I put this class together, I was very impressed with and interested in Diana Eck's lectures. So she was somebody that I'd known as a scholar for quite a long time, but I really hadn't been aware of her interest in pluralism and religious pluralism. I just knew she was a great scholar, an Indologist. This is a person who specializes in the study of India. Curiously, what I didn't know about her, and I think I'm giving away a little something at the moment, is that she's a committed Christian, which is actually kind of, in the world of scholarship, unusual. Generally, when you find professors who are very interested in Asian religions, they're interested in Asian religions because it's relevant to their own inner life in some way. That more often than not always. But she's a committed Christian. And you get this when you listen to the Gifford lectures. So that's important, because there are 4 points here in what she describes as being pluralism and defining pluralism. And I want to kind of go through this stuff with you just really briefly, and then go back into the course syllabus, because I want you to see the approach that I'm taking in this class as contrasted to what Eck is proposing as religious pluralism, which is going to seem an irony, because I said the organizing principle of the class is pluralism. But it doesn't mean the same thing to me as it does to her, and it doesn't have to mean the same thing to you either. So I don't know if that makes any sense or not, but let's give this a try and see where it goes. And if it doesn't make any sense, tell me it's not making any sense. First off, she does talk about the distinction between pluralism and diversity. And I'm not going to ask if everybody watched the first of the Gifford lectures last night. You wouldn't have known that you needed to. But for the rest of us, well, you wouldn't have either. But for the rest of us, it was sort of an assignment. Okay. So as she points out, we live in the United States in a diverse society. And she uses a lot of examples because she lives in the Boston-Cambridge area. So unlike LeGrand, she lives in a world where if you go down the street, basically the whole world is around you. That's the nature of life in Cambridge these days. It's not the Cambridge of 100 years ago, which was essentially a Christian, mostly, environment, except for some Jews who lived there, and they weren't very popular at Harvard at that point. That's a whole other story. But it was basically a Christian world at that time. It's not so anymore. It's a very diverse world. And she points out that it's like that all over the United States now. Even in Bozeman, which is where she grew up, which I find kind of amazing. It's not like I know Bozeman very well, but the fact that there's a Hindu temple in Bozeman is kind of astonishing to me. That would almost be like having a Hindu temple in LeGrand. Okay. But she points out diversity, which is the nature of the United States now from a cultural point of view for quite a while, but from a religious point of view for some more limited period of time. Diversity is not the same as pluralism. Diversity is just there's a lot of different stuff going on, but pluralism is a certain attitude toward diversity. And this is where I believe she's betraying her Christian background, her Christian orientation. So I'm going to ask, does anybody have an idea where I'm going with this before I go there, just for the sake of curiosity? Does anybody know why I'm making this point and how you see a Christian background in this idea of pluralism that Eck is proposing?
Hello.
Yeah, Alex. Right.
I'm not trying to like
Taylor.
Preach or nothing, but
it's okay.
Didn't Jesus kind of talk about acceptance and tolerance no matter what you are? Is that kind of the Christian background she's talking about?
Did he?
I haven't read the Bible. So.
Yeah. What is your name?
Josie.
Yeah. Okay. Did
he? I promise I didn't ditch the class yesterday.
It doesn't
I
matter.
I signed up yesterday at like 5. So.
Welcome.
I'm a student. I like the school.
I wasn't making any point about people who weren't here.
Well, one student showed up today. Look. No, it wasn't me. I mean, the Bible back then, it was a matter-of-fact book. Nowadays, there's a bunch of precedents that comes in where people view different things in different ways, such as, I mean, being accepting of others. But he also said things along the line of slavery and how one must act towards a slave, see towards a slave. And I don't know. I don't think it's really... Like, yeah, there's background, and maybe the way she views her Christianity as, like, the pluralism of the attitude towards diversity, and maybe, like, that's where someone could say...
The idea of active acceptance, perhaps.
Yeah,
is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, there's also just the other side of the conservative thinking.
Right, which, to use my language, would be more what I would call fundamentalist view of things. And we will talk about that, and so we'll have to define what I mean by fundamentalism. But what I'm trying to suggest here is that the idea of pluralism that she's proposing is akin to the idea that we need to accept each other in some way and embrace each other in some way and love each other in some way, which is very much in the Christian teaching. I mean... Pluralism is not diversity, but the energetic engagement with diversity. That means you relate to people who are different than you. Not only that, but you want to understand them. Pluralism is not just tolerance, but the act of seeking of understanding across lines of difference. It's not relativism, but the encounter of commitments, which is to say, I'm a Christian, you're a Muslim, we need to get to know each other and understand each other, but we're going to be different and we're going to believe things that are different. And that's an important point. We're going to come back to that and what relativism is. And pluralism is based upon dialogue. We need to talk with each other. Okay, do we happen to have any veterans in this class who've been to the Middle East? No. Related to any veterans who've been to the Middle East?
My uncles and all my cousins are over in Iraq right now. My dad's a Marine.
And was he in Iraq or
yes,
Afghanistan?
Yeah, Afghanistan.
And?
My husband's cousin is in Afghanistan.
Okay. So if you were speaking to your relatives who were surrounded by Muslim world, would they say that, yep, those folks are really interested in having a dialogue with us and that they accept the idea that we're different than them and it's all okay? Or would they say, what are you guys doing here? What are you women doing here? And you're carrying guns and you have some very definite ideas about the way the world is supposed to be that don't align with ours. That was a cough, not a comment. Okay, I thought you wanted to say something there. David, right?
Yeah.
See, I was looking at the Facebook last night and also this morning so I could learn your names. I'll take your photo, too. It's the way I'll learn everybody's name as quickly as I can. I'm not good at names, so I'm really going to work on it. Katie, right? Okay. See, this idea of pluralism is not going to be accepted by many people in many parts of the world. But Eck is making the point that we still have a globally, thank you, Forrest, is making the point that we have a globally connected world, you know. You turn on the news at night, and of course you see that. But in urban settings, the whole world is there. And for those of us who live in non-urban settings like the Grand, at least in the mental space that we occupy, because we occupy the mental space of the internet so significantly. Anybody in this class doesn't have a smartphone? Oh, I'm surprised. Okay. You're going to get him to, yeah, right. If you have a smartphone, right, you have the world in your pocket or your purse. And your mind, every time you stare into that screen, your mind is staring into a global mental space. Because you can do things through that smartphone that are quite amazing. For example, Sunday night, I got an email that ran along the lines of, the Dalai Lama is doing a certain kind of teaching on a certain book in Dharamsala, which is 12 and a half hours away because it's in the Himalayan mountains. He's doing a certain kind of teaching on a certain kind of book, which interests me because I'm a scholar of the author of that book, not that particular book, but that particular author that lived almost 2,000 years ago. So he's doing a teaching on it in Dharamsala in the Himalayas, which is going to be live webcast. And I thought, well, that's cool. Okay. So it's happening at 8 o'clock in the morning, Dharamsala time. So I sat down at my computer, and I watched him walk across a courtyard in his monastery, where I have been many times, watched him walk into a temple, where I have been many times, and I would have watched him teaching and listened to him teaching, except the live stream was buffering so badly that every 20 seconds it cut out for 20 seconds, and it drove me crazy. I don't know if that was happening on the Indian side or the DSL connection that I have or what was happening. But that's not the point. I could have watched the same thing on the smartphone in my pocket, which means I could take that phone out of my pocket and I could stare into that little screen and my eyes would open out into a Himalayan world with a bunch of Tibetans and Chinese sitting around having a conversation. That's globalization here. 2 years ago, I was in Yakima, Washington. Yakima, as some people say. I was in Yakima, Washington. Actually, I like Yakima. I was sitting in a sushi restaurant run by Japanese in Yakima. I was sitting next to a Tibetan Lama whose iPhone rang. He pulled it out of his bag and he started having this conversation in Tibetan. When the conversation was over, I said, Rinpoche, what was that all about? He said, I just got a call from my monks at my monastery in eastern Tibet. They wanted my advice. What they wanted my advice about was they wanted to stage a demonstration. They wanted to stage a demonstration against Chinese oppression of the monasteries in their region. I said, well, Rinpoche, that's interesting. What did you tell them? He said, well, I'd had a call from somebody at another monastery 25 kilometers away where all the troops were stationed. And I told them that if they did this, what was going to happen was those troops were going to attack them and a lot of people were going to get killed. So they really should not stage that demonstration. Okay. Globalization, what was happening there? I'm sitting in a Japanese restaurant in Yakima, Washington, next to a Tibetan monk who is organizing monastic activity in eastern Tibet to avoid conflict with Chinese who have invaded that country, from his point of view and also from my point of view. Okay. That's the world we live in. So how are we going to deal with living in this world? That's part of what Eck is talking about. So that's just my personal experience of that kind of globalization. I mentioned that example because we don't think of that sort of thing happening in La Grande. But I mean, La Grande, Yakima, what's the big difference? I mean, one's only a little bit larger than the other. When you get right down to it, there's not that much difference. Okay, that's the world we live in. So Eck wants to deal with it. But her idea of how to deal with it is what I'm saying is essentially a Christian idea. Because if you ask your relatives in the Middle East, is this how they think that the Muslims around them want to deal with the diversity of American troops in Afghanistan or Iraq? Do you think that that's true? No. I don't think so. All right. So this idea of pluralism might work in the United States. So maybe that's a good beginning. But having said all of this, now to go back to the syllabus, finally. When we get to talking about, where did it go? Here we go. When we get to talking about the Dalai Lama and secular ethics, what we're going to find out is there is a Buddhist view on this problem, which is actually quite similar to the Christian view. And that's interesting in itself. But I have to tell you, before we get into this too far, I don't know if I'm going to flip week 3 and week 4. It might be that in week 3 we talk about the Dalai Lama, and in week 4 we talk about Ramakrishna, or it might be the other way around. Now, why am I doing this? Why am I, what's going on here in the course syllabus? Too cold?
I couldn't hear you very well.
Oh, okay, sorry. Maybe next time we'll open that window, but not now. Okay. The course syllabus and the way I've organized the syllabus is a response to Eck's ideas about pluralism. Not so much that I either agree or disagree with her ideas about pluralism, but there's a problem with her ideas about pluralism, which is they represent a certain single specific cultural point of view, which I've identified as being a Christian point of view. Not too radically different from what used to be called the social gospel in the early 20th century. Go out and do good. The whole social welfare movement of pure food, pure water, good working conditions was quite related to a Christian idea of how we should be in a, at that time, viewed as at least a Judeo-Christian nation or a Christian nation. And nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that, and nothing wrong with this idea, but it represents a specific point of view. And the question is, if that's the case, and if she's proposing it as a resolution to a global problem, is this another case of America imposing its views on a world? For example, it is the policy of the United States to promote democracy everywhere. That doesn't mean everywhere wants democracy, okay, or thinks highly of it, let alone is it going to work everywhere. And what does it mean when people in the Middle East at the time of the Arab Spring claimed that they wanted democracy? What did they really want? Did they want democracy, which means each of us votes to create a government that is at our functions at our behest? Did they want liberty, but they called it democracy? Or did they want economic improvement and called it democracy? I'll go for the latter myself. Yeah?
This is kind of off subject, but what do you think about the government shutting down?
Let's save that for the end of class.
Okay.
And I will. I will tell you what I think about it. Okay. But I'll lose my train of thought if we go down that line. All right. So, pluralism as a way of promoting a specific point of view. Now, one of the things that EOU has done in instituting the DPD requirement, and so this class meets that requirement, is to address these sorts of issues, such as, is there an issue with our promoting a single point of view as if it is a general good for the world? And the answer would be probably. Okay, so if we're really going to understand the issue of pluralism or the multiplicity of cultures and religions that are in profound and deep interconnection with each other, and we're going to do it realistically and actually pluralistically, truthfully pluralistically, then we have to look at the question not just from the point of view of America and a potentially Christian point of view, but we have to look at it from the point of view of people in other parts of the world. We really should look at it from the point of view of Al-Qaeda. But I think we know what we'll see if we look at it from the point of view of Al-Qaeda, at least from the point of view of Islam. We could, but I'm not going to. What we are going to do is we're going to look at it from a Buddhist point of view, and that's why we're going to be reading what the Dalai Lama has to say about it, because he's one of the most prolific and respected global leaders in Buddhism. So it's not just because I happen to like him, but there's another reason for it. Also, from a Hindu point of view, all right? So we're going to look at this question from the point of view of Christianity, which will be ek, and also, if I roll this page down a little bit, let's see what happens here. From the point of view of ek, and, oh, I went the wrong way. Here we go. Ek and hik, that's interesting. Diana Ek and John Hick, essentially Christian points of view on the issue of plurality, or globalism, pluralism. A Hindu point of view, and then a Buddhist point of view. We'll at least have three points of view from three radically different cultural stances on how to deal with the complex interrelationship of different faiths that have to coexist in this small world, a world that's so small that, as I said, I can be sitting in a sushi restaurant next to somebody who's directing peaceful resistance in eastern Tibet and is aware of Chinese troop movements in doing so. That's what I call a small world. Then what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a radical proposal to you, which Ek would counter as wrong way to go. And in fact, the Dalai Lama would counter as wrong way to go. But I'm going to follow a point of view that's established by Ramakrishna, a Hindu, which is to explore the question of, is there an underlying truth to all religious experience that can serve as a basis for not necessarily harmony, but for at least understanding what's going on in the inner life of people? Okay. I'm going to propose an answer to that question, and then we're going to explore it. Now, as I said, from Ek's point of view, that's the wrong way to go, because it's saying that there really is something there, and I'm not just being in dialogue with other religious types. I'm saying there is something underlying. And I'm saying it's something in the nature of the human mind. So I'm also going to be following what the Dalai Lama talks about, which is looking at something underlying in the human condition, which we all share, no matter who we are on this planet, because we're all human beings. Science has told us something about what it means to be a human being. And science potentially could tell us what is going on in the inner life that we call religion and religiosity, maybe. We'll take it as a hypothesis, and we'll explore it a bit. And we'll do so by looking at the psychology of Carl Jung. We'll look at the human potential movement that arose in the middle of the 20th century. And then finally, at the end of the class, we'll look at some physiological, psychological, cognitive, psychological studies that may tell us something. And so where will we end up? We'll go back to the question again of pluralism, and how do you think about pluralism based upon having gone through that whole trajectory. You may not agree with me. That's fine. Sometimes I don't even agree with me. I change my mind. So it happens, you know. But we'll see. That's the trajectory of the class, and that's what I wanted to share with you as kind of an overview. Now, having said all of that, okay, any questions? This is going to be a tough one, right? It's 1 o'clock. Lunchtime is 12 to 1, so we'll see how we do. No questions at this point? All right. What do I think about shutting the government down? I had a friend who said, you know, it's the nature of democracy, and it's the nature of politics, that everyone wrestles the beast to the ground to get what they want by whatever method they want. That's what we live with. If you ask my personal point of view, I'd find myself agreeing with, of all people, John McCain, because I'm not a Republican, so I say of all people, John McCain, who I heard on the news the other day, I guess actually even yesterday, saying, you know, the argument happened a couple years ago, and a decision was made. So that's that. Let's just get on with things. So I think McCain is a pretty reasonable person to be quoting. Yourself?
I just heard on the internet that it shut down because they couldn't come up with some kind of decision, and that all the national forests are being, all those people are going out of, you know, jobs.
Yes?
I was just going to say, I mean, when you're talking about democracy and all that, and it goes along with yours. Sorry, you feel like I'm cutting him off.
Katie, right?
Yeah. I think this might, I don't know. I think we would have never had this problem had Obama not been in office.
It's true. We would have had different problems.
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely. I think we would have had far different problems on the other side of the spectrum. But I think the problem is that Obama, he, I don't know how to word it, he's all for moving forward, all about change. While, say, we had Romney in office, he is a conservative. He's far more to the base of what our country was started on, and I think the government shutdown is just a way for them to say, because we do have a lot of conservatives, whether some people say it or not, I think it's their way of saying, like, this is how we want stuff done, and even though we don't have that control, we're trying to find the control that, we're trying to find control some way, somehow, even though...
Whatever tool is at hand is what we're going to use to further our objectives.
Even the tools that don't exist, they're trying to find them.
Well, actually, this tool has existed for a while because the way the country was set up in the balance of power was that the Congress has control over the money. I mean, so you go back to Theodore Roosevelt. So Theodore Roosevelt, at one point, wanted to make a geopolitical point of view. So he wanted to send the American fleet around the world to make his point of view. Congress didn't really want to fund what he was doing. So he figured out that there was enough money in the budget to send the fleet about as far as the Philippines, or anyway, however far it was. But it got basically halfway around the world. And then he said, would you like the fleet to come back? I guess you better vote some money. He said this to the Congress, I guess you better vote some money to the War Department at the time to pay for the fleet to buy the fuel that it needs so you can get it back here. Well, he's basically just doing the same thing that you're talking about. You use the tool that's at hand. Yes, Forrest, I'm sorry.
What country were we talking about?
Which one? At what point?
The government shutdown.
This one.
Right on.
So why are you asking that question?
I wasn't aware
that the government...
I'm not, like, I don't look at the news. Oh. I'm not very informed.
The federal government is currently on permanent vacation, except Social Security checks are being cut and essential services like air traffic controllers are in place. But non-essentials like rangers in the national parks and probably... Well, the Border Patrol is in place. But I don't know. Maybe there's nobody home at the FBI.
I was told that the military still has to serve, but they're not getting paid for it.
Really? Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's not very popular.
I think they did have something so they would get paid.
Yeah.
But NASA, International Mode Organization, but the post office is still running.
I think Cheryl had her hand up.
Oh, no, we got my question
answered. Oh, okay. Then Alex. I think I'm doing pretty well with the names.
I heard about
because I watched Daily Show and they're making fun of it. Mm. But something about Syria.
Syria?
They're having weapons of chemical warfare or something, so Obama said don't do that. Mm-hmm. And they're making fun of saying that we've pretty much just handed control back to the Russians or something.
That's a complicated, different issue about,
saying,
yeah.
Was that before or after the government
shutdown? Not related to the government shutdown.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, not related to the government shutdown. That's related to a long history with Russia and Syria being very close to each other. So I don't know if you know this. We're going to get pretty far aside here. But that's okay. That's okay. You know, after the Second World War, we had something that was called the Cold War. Well, it's not actually related to pluralism, if you know, think about it. We had something called the Cold War, which was the communist bloc jockeying for geopolitical power and the Western nations doing the same. And what it really boiled down to was the great powers, which was the Soviet Union, now Russia on one side, and the United States and some of Europe on the other side. Communism versus capitalism was presumably what it was about, but what it was actually about was economic empires that were in conflict with each other. And the presumption was that it was over the principles of communism and capitalism. As a cynic, I'll tell you, though, that the truth of it, as far as I'm concerned, was basically about which of us has the bigger stick and is going to be the top dog and is going to run the world. And in doing this, we're going to manipulate all these other smaller countries to be on our side, or at least not to be on their side. And so some really weird stuff happened, but we're still paying for the consequences of that. And one of the things that happened was the Soviet Union developed a relationship with Syria and supported Syria. So historically, the Syrians and the Russians are close to each other, and one of the things that makes the folks in Washington uncomfortable is that relationship and the history of that relationship. So the reason that Obama and Putin are not getting along with each other as well as they might over this issue of what's happening in Syria has to do with history as much as anything else. That's my point of view anyway. That has nothing to do with this class. That's okay. That's fine. Yeah.
So oil and the sale of arms.
Tell me more.
Well, economically, Russia sells a lot to arms to Syria, and Syrian oil
goes to
valuable to Russia.
I didn't know about the Syrian oil because the Russians have so much oil, but maybe historically that was more the case. The oil, or the arms. Well, I can't answer that question either.
It's just a piece.
Okay. All right. So, back to pluralism. That's all right. I think it's fine for us to kind of talk about other stuff. I mean, the theme that we're really dealing with is a globalized world. And so all this stuff is going to constantly intrude. So one of the things that I was thinking about bringing into the class was something called was Japan, talking about Fukushima. But maybe we won't go there right now. But we'll have the opportunity because the problem there isn't going to go away. Back to pluralism. So does everybody really want to engage? I mean, for pluralism to go from what Eck is calling, the difference between what Eck is calling diversity and pluralism has a lot to do with people's relationship and communication with each other. And that you cannot live in a pluralistic environment unless people are going to talk to each other and get to know each other. So what do you think?
What are the prospects for pluralism in our world? What are the prospects for pluralism in the United States? Yes, Alex.
What I got out of it was like kind of like at the table metaphor.
with in Maryland, they said there's all these different churches, like, right on the same street. They can't, they're diverse, but they can't really be pluralistic unless maybe all of them get together for, like, a big picnic or something.
Mm.
And they all talk to each other without really arguing with each other.
Or trying to convert each other.
Or trying to convert each other.
But that is the problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
That is the problem. Because what happens in a world where I've got the truth, but my truth is different than yours? What does that mean about you? How many of you, yeah, well, but this is significant. How many of the people in this class are married? So, sort of.
Getting close.
But you've been with somebody for a while.
Next summer.
All right. But you've been with somebody for a while. So most of the people in this class have had long-standing relationships with another person. How often is it when you're right? That your spouse is also right or wrong if you disagree. How often can you disagree and be absolutely sure that you're right and not try and convince your spouse that your spouse is wrong?
What's the secret word I say when I don't want to admit I'm wrong?
What's that?
I say avocado.
Avocado. How does that work?
He's admitted that I'm wrong, but he knows I'm wrong.
And you'll fess up. Okay, avocado. All right, suppose, let's just take an example here. Suppose the monthly income is $900. I'm just picking a number out of the air. Hopefully.
I wish that was my monthly income.
Okay. Suppose the monthly income is $900, whether that's a lot or a little, let's just say it's $900. And the bills are $1,000 this month. And the agreement is we're not going into debt. Well, first off, you're going to have to break that agreement. But second off, you're going to have to decide which bills to pay or not pay, or how you're going to pay which bills. What happens if you don't agree? The bills still have to be paid, don't they? What happens in that situation with those two people, yourself and your spouse? How does it get worked out? Does it get worked out? And in this situation, what kind of agreement can you come to?
Well, whichever one I think is more important should be paid. And then next month, whatever he thinks is important.
Okay. That would be a reasonable solution. But for this month, what if he disagrees with you? And doesn't want to say we're going to switch off for next month? I'm in charge of the bills, so we're going to pay the bills the way I say. Okay?
I don't argue with it.
This is a Christian nation, and we're not having any of that Ramadan or any of that other stuff. That's basically, from a religious point of view, that's what you're saying. I'm not being critical of you as you. I'm just saying, but that's that stance, which is, this is the way it is. The problem is that over ultimates, sometimes people are not willing to negotiate. If your eternal soul depends upon a decision that's been made, are you willing to negotiate that decision if you believe you have an eternal soul? If you believe you have an eternal soul, are you willing to negotiate certain kinds of situations and decisions? See, I think that this is where pluralism breaks down in a significant way. That it's a great concept, and it's probably a civic virtue in the United States, but I think there's some problems. Yeah, Alex.
So is pluralism kind of like a lot of people have told me like the idea of communism.
communism is really good, but worked out in practice isn't good. So is that kind of like pluralism? The idea is very good, but it's hard to work out the practice and make it perfect.
Now, that's a very interesting approach to the problem, because it might be the case that what I'm proposing is we need to figure out a way to work out a practice for what's a good ideal that's not succeeding. That might be a very good way to characterize what I'm going to try and do in the class. Let's see. Muhammad says in the Quran, I'm going to pick on the Muslims a lot, not because I don't like them. I actually do like them. I teach a course on Islam here. But I'm going to pick on them a little bit because we understand Muslim fundamentalism. And I don't want to pick on Christian fundamentalism because I don't know who I would offend if I did. But I don't think there are any Muslims in this class, so I can probably get away with it. Any Muslims in this class? No. Okay, so I can get away with it. According to Muhammad, there will be no prophets that follow him. He's the last of the prophets. He's the seal of the prophets. That means what? Anybody belong to the LDS Church? Anybody in here belong to the LDS Church? It means that the people that founded the LDS Church are wrong.
So does him saying that he is the last prophet, he's the last of the prophet, mean that he's the one that kind of has the final say?
That's right. And nobody has anything to say about anything after him. So what kind of problems does that create?
No one can have an argument, and those who do are wrong.
Wrong. So how do the Muslims work this out? Well, actually, I'll tell you later how the Muslims work this out. There is a way to work it out if they want to, but you see the problem that's created. Okay, how about, all right, let's just briefly go to the Christian place, and then we'll move on from there next time we meet. How about nobody comes to the Father except through me? okay, that's the way the early Christian church went with its power structure. But let's talk about what's in the Gospels. Okay, there's a statement in the Gospels. Jesus says, nobody comes to the Father except through me. So the way that gets interpreted by conservative Christians is, unless you are a follower of Jesus, you cannot find God. And so what happens if you don't find God and you die, which you will? What happens to you?
You don't go to heaven, you go to heaven.
And if you don't go to heaven, where do you go?
Hell.
Okay, so what does that mean?
Purgatory.
Well, if you believe in purgatory, but not all Christians do.
But they all believe in heaven and hell, if they're actually Christians. Because purgatory is actually a Catholic concept, which was invented, by the way, which is interesting because it's not in the oldest.
You make sure you baptize your babies.
What's that?
You have to make sure you baptize your babies.
That's one way of thinking about it. Okay, so if you don't go to heaven, you're going to go to hell, and if you don't believe in Jesus, you're not going to go to heaven. Unless, of course, you're a Muslim, in which case, what? Well, you're not going to get to. Anyhow, you see where this goes? So this is the thorny problem. All right, so if you haven't viewed this first lecture by Eck, which is called Globalism and Religious Pluralism, please do so tonight. And if you have, then please look at the second one, The New Cosmopolis, Cities and Realities of Religious Pluralism. Okay? And we'll continue this discussion tomorrow. Hopefully a discussion and not my talking and your listening. Yeah, I know. So you might fall behind, and if you do, don't worry about it. I'm not going to hold anybody to it. Yeah. Are we okay? We're good? I don't want to be distressing anybody, but I do need to lay out the problems. So that's it. See you tomorrow.